Good afternoon, listeners. This is the Dogs Program, the Australian Council for Defence of Government Schools. We're here every Saturday at 12 noon to promote and to defend public education. And of course, that means public education teachers. So we're very interested and we're very proud to be able to announce that there's an upcoming rally by public school teachers outside Ben Carroll's office on the 16th of July after school at 4:45 p.m. And where is Ben Carroll's office? It's at 473 Keilor Road, Nidri. 473 Keilor Road, Nidri, Ben Carroll's office on the 16th of July at 4:45 p.m. for teachers who are unhappy with what the present Labor government here in Victoria are offering them. Now, we can go straight ahead from that into a new press release, 1073. Now, I'm very sorry, but we'll be talking about America in part here, because the Dogs are against the taxpayer funding of private religious schools. We believe that this is against the section 116 of the Australian Constitution and the separation of religion from the state. But of course, the High Court has read section 116 narrowly and almost out of the Constitution. And that hasn't happened to date in America, because section 116 is based on the First Amendment. But now things under the Trump government are also in trouble in America. So that's what our press release 1073 is about. Let's hear from Andy, shall we?
Thanks, Jean. And this is the Australian Council for the Defence of Government Schools, press release number 1073. Separation of religion and state. The New World, the Old, and its implications for Australian education. If readers go to the section of this website which deals with the High Court case, they will read the story of how the Dogs went to the Australian High Court in the period 1979 to 1981 to test the giving of state aid to private religious schools under section 116 of the Australian Constitution. This is the Religious Liberty Clause, which prevents the Commonwealth federal government from establishing any religion, imposing religious observances, banning the free exercise of any religion, or requiring religious tests to hold public office. The section was introduced by Andrew Inglis Clark and Henry Burns Higgins into the Australian Constitution, and in the Australian Constitutional Convention debates, there was evidence that the Founding Fathers believed that it prevented state entanglement with religious schools through state aid to religious schools. The Founding Fathers in Australia were not anti-religion. Like their American predecessors, they did not want to bring the bloody religious wars of the old world into their new country. The Dogs case was a long, rather sad saga in which the church school interest lobbied politicians and undermined the legal system for 15 years, keeping the plaintiffs out of court. There was a 26-day trial of facts in 1979 in which the church interest attempted to prove that religious schools were no more religious than public schools. This was meant to break the Dogs financially, but through the financial sacrifice of a few people, the case was heard in 1980. But the Barwick Court, Justice Murphy in dissent, found that the Establishment Clause establishing any religion only meant establishing a particular state religion. This very narrow interpretation has rendered our Religious Liberty Clause almost meaningless and opened the floodgates to the billions and billions of dollars pouring into an 18th century type denominational religious system, dividing our children according to creed, colour and class. Now, in the United States, as Trump takes that country back into an autocracy, the original meaning of the First Amendment, upon which our Section 116 is based, is also under threat. As we contemplate the consequences of entanglement of the Australian state with religious leaders and administrators who compromise their very basic beliefs, the decline of our democratic institutions, the undermining of our public education system, and the future of our children, the following article, published in The Conversation in the last week, is very much to the point. The US Founders' Other Revolutionary Choice, Separating Religion and Government. Did the founders of the United States intend to create a Christian nation? Political leaders who addressed a prayer rally on the National Mall on May the 17th, 2026, seemed to think so. House Speaker Mike Johnson led the crowd in rededicating the United States of America as one nation under God. Some, and perhaps many, scholars would say no, that while many founders were religious, as a group they concluded that the national government should not support any particular faith. As a scholar of colonial North America, I believe that history provides an answer. European colonisers in lands that become the United States did link church and state, but the architects of the new nation broke from that idea as surely as they broke from Britain. The European desire to expand the boundaries of Christendom played a central role in the colonial era, as I describe in my 2026 book, Contested Continent. That drive mattered greatly to Christopher Columbus, who sailed west in 1492. Upon landing in the Bahamas, he laid claim to already populated territories, writing that Christ would rejoice as he foresees that so many souls of so many people heretofore lost are to be saved. The doctrine of discovery, proclaimed by the Vatican in 1493, granted European monarchs title over lands occupied by non-Christians and urged them to convert the people who lived there. Less than a generation later, the Protestant Reformation transformed Christianity, dividing Europe and spawning brutal violence. In England, the schism reshaped the relationship between church and state. King Henry VIII severed ties with the Pope in the 1530s. He ordered the dissolution of monasteries, and his followers defaced church statues of Catholic saints. After Henry rejected Rome's authority, Parliament passed the Supremacy Act of 1534, which made the monarch the leader of an independent national church, the Church of England. Queen Elizabeth I, Henry's daughter, further reduced the political power of English Catholics in 1559. Her desire to promote her Protestant faith, along with a yearning to expand England's political authority, helped fuel a vicious campaign to take control of Ireland, where the Reformation's teachings had not taken hold. The desire to promote Protestantism also figured in English plans for the colonisation of North America. In the 1580s, an expedition sent by Sir Walter Raleigh arrived in the outer banks of what is now North Carolina. They were eager to learn about the region's natural resources and its peoples. English colonial planners also hoped to convert Carolina Algonquians and to keep Catholics away. A small group of Jesuit priests had already tried to establish a mission on a tributary of Chesapeake Bay in 1571, but they were killed by indigenous people. Thomas Harriot, who chronicled the English efforts when he arrived in 1585, believed that Carolina Algonquians would convert to Protestantism. In fact, he wrote, native people were so eager to accept the faith that they grabbed a Bible to embrace it, to kiss it, to hold it to their breasts in order to absorb the lessons it contained. In 1607, the Virginia Company of London established a settlement at Jamestown, promising, according to the colony's 1609 charter, that colonisation would lead to the conversion and reduction of the people in those parties into the true worship of God and Christian religion. To advance their goal, they tried to bar anyone holding the superstitions of the Church of Rome. Colonists had to swear the oath of supremacy to the English monarch, which meant accepting the Church of England. Within a generation, other Protestants arrived in English America, including critics of the Church of England, who are now often called pilgrims. Puritans, who migrated soon after, held similar beliefs. Persecuted in England for their dissenting views, they arrived eager to demonstrate to the world that they knew the best ways to advance a civilization based on their interpretation of Scripture. Among these migrants was John Winthrop, a leader of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. In 1630, he wrote what became the most famous sermon in early America, although he was not a minister and likely never delivered it to a congregation. Winthrop advocated the blending of church and state, as he put it, drawing on the Bible's Book of Matthew, "We shall be as a city upon a hill, the eyes of all people are upon us." Colonists' failure, he suggested, would be a victory for the enemies of God. English advocates of colonisation were aware that Catholics had been erecting churches in modern-day Mexico and Peru. Protestants feared that Rome's influence might spread across the East Coast, moving southward from French Canada and northward from Spanish Florida. While English authorities allowed limited migration of Catholics, especially to Maryland, their colonies remained Protestant strongholds. No single official church establishment stretched across the 13 colonies that would eventually join in the American Revolution, but church and state were closely related in each. European colonizers in lands that became the United States did link church and state, but the architects of the new nation broke from that idea as surely as they broke from Britain. towns across New England taxed residents to support local congregational churches, which evolved out of Puritan traditions. Colonial governments established the Church of England in Virginia in 1619 and in New York in 1693. Pennsylvania's 1682 frame of government promised that law-abiding people would not be persecuted for their religious views or forced to do worship. But those who held public office needed to possess faith in Jesus Christ. Even Rhode Island, famous for its tradition of tolerance, specified in its 1663 charter that residents should edify themselves and one another in the holy Christian faith. By the mid-1770s, many colonial Americans decided that the time had come to separate from Great Britain. Many also wanted to separate church and state. In 1777, just a year after he drafted the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson wrote Virginia's Statute for Religious Freedom. As he put it, one's ability to serve the public should have no dependence on our religious opinions, any more than on our opinions in physics or geometry. When the statute became law in Virginia in 1786, it protected freedom of worship and ended taxes to support the Church of England. Article 6 of the United States Constitution, written in Philadelphia in 1787, forbade any religious oaths for those who wanted to hold office. The First Amendment, which became part of the Constitution in late 1791, held that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. The leaders of the American Revolution did not agree on all matters of faith, but had they wanted public support of religious institutions, they had plenty of models at hand, including the Church of England. They decided instead that a durable republic could best survive if politics and religion inhabited different spheres. This recognition contradicted almost two centuries of colonial practice, making it among the most radical achievements of the founding era. Back to you, Jane.
Well, thank you very much, Andy. And there are good reasons, of course, and we're going to talk about them now, for the separation of religion from the state. We've seen in Australia billions and billions of dollars going into one particular church's schools, and we're confronted with the fact that the Christian Brothers schools, which are part of this church's school system, have been responsible for the abuse, the sexual abuse of children. But to get out of paying those children who've now grown up any compensation, they've been engaging in some very, very interesting accountancy and property procedures. Shall we hear about it? We did talk about it last week, but there's been further information and discussion of this. And Dale's going to tell us all about it.
Thanks, Jean. This is an article from The Guardian by Christopher Nouse. Quote, obviously disturbing, unquote, if Christian Brothers $1 property sales deprive abuse survivors of pay, government tells court. Concerns Catholic Order's historical transfers of millions in asset were potentially inappropriate, New South Wales Supreme Court hears. Lawyers for the federal government say they are concerned at the disturbing potential that the Christian Brothers Catholic Order may have inappropriately transferred property to another entity years before claiming it was broke and couldn't afford to pay abuse survivors' civil claims. The New South Wales Supreme Court ordered a moratorium on all abuse claims against the Christian Brothers, a Catholic order that played a significant role in the church's child sexual abuse scandal. The Christian Brothers sought the moratorium because the order said it was going broke and wanted to establish a separate scheme to sell off its remaining property and divide the proceeds between a range of creditors, including survivors. The Christian Brothers estimates it owes $774 million to survivors with current or future abuse claims against it. It says it has 36 remaining properties worth $216 million under its control. The moratorium will give time for survivors to consider whether to support the Christian Brothers proposal. But significant concerns have emerged about the way the Christian Brothers has transferred property, land, school buildings, and homes around the sites of its former schools out of its control to another entity, Edmund Rice Education Australia, EREA, over the past decade. Property records obtained by The Guardian show those transfers were made for $1 each, even in cases where they involved multi-million dollar homes in Sydney. REEA, named after the founder of the Christian Brothers, was established as an independent entity in 2007 to assume control of former Christian Brothers schools. The Australian Financial Review first reported that the land transfers were worth $891 million in late 2024 and may now be valued at $2 billion. In a hearing before the New South Wales Supreme Court, Sarah Mirzabegian, SC, representing the Commonwealth, said the federal government was concerned to ensure that institutions take responsibility for abuse and that they provide appropriate compensation. Mirzabegian said the Commonwealth had particular concerns about historical asset transfers between the Christian Brothers and EREA and whether they were proper and appropriate. She said it would be obviously disturbing if the transfers resulted in assets not being available to compensate survivors. The court heard that the scheme proposed by the Christian Brothers would preserve the rights of creditors, including survivors, to pursue assets transferred to EREA. The Christian Brothers had provided 15 pages of evidence to the court about the nature of those property transfers. But Mirzabegian said the evidence contained significant discrepancies, including about the value of the land that had been transferred. What is abundantly clear from that evidence is that it unfortunately raises more questions than it answers, Mirzabegian said. An EREA spokesperson previously told The Guardian the property was transferred as part of a slow, progressive process of turning over Christian Brothers school land and property to EREA, which was delayed by what the spokesperson describes as the complexity of transferring individual titles across multiple jurisdictions. Justice Scott Nixon ordered the moratorium on Thursday, halting claims against the Christian Brothers. The moratorium will give time for survivors to consider the property sell-off scheme and decide whether they wish to support it. Without the moratorium, Nixon said, the opportunity to consider the scheme would be lost. The Christian Brothers has previously said that if their proposed scheme is not supported, the order will go into liquidation and survivors will likely receive even less. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you so much. It makes you feel rather sad, doesn't it? Particularly if people are genuine Christians. But something very interesting happened to us this week. We got a letter on the email from a parent who was very supportive of the dogs, because this parent had had some pretty bad experiences with private schools. You see, the difference between public and private schools is that public schools take everybody. They can't refuse the enrolment of anybody that is in the zone or the area that they are servicing. And so taxpayers' money should go towards that. But private schools are able to grab the money and run, but not do the job. Let's hear about it, shall we, from Dale.
Thanks, Jean. This is an email we received from a parent, Andre Denitz, with some interesting claims about alleged rorting by private schools when it comes to claiming students with disability. It reads, "We had some extremely dishonest experiences with one of the independent Catholic schools that you have mentioned in press releases that consistently ranks up to 230% overfunded for their highly sketchy NCCD claims." Of course, the NCCD is Nationally Consistent Collection of Data on School Students with Disability. The email continues, "They weaponized our enrollment contract for both girls over their covert and dishonest NCCD federal funding misappropriation. When directly asked if either girl was listed under NCCD, we were told in no uncertain terms that this was absolutely none of our business, and had to use their own policies and procedures to force finding out. These schools run a horrendously dishonest systemic NCCD program with complete lack of any collaboration. Instead of providing any explanation or reasonable evidence for any disability, I was instead, for questioning this, banned from entering school grounds. They then rewrote the entire school's enrollment contract from one page to over five and terminated our enrollment for both girls, neither of whom had any disabilities whatsoever. Neither girl ever had any educational disabilities. One was being considered for gifted programs and topped the state in NAPLAN and won an international ICAS award. Andre asks, did you know that these schools not only double dip the federal funding, they also get significant additional time for standardized tests as they have around one third the cohort imputed under this sketchy scheme? These schools convert things such as mild bullying into redescriptive engineered social adjustments. So not only do the schools have bullying, they profit from it. Charity wash it, and then straight into whatever they see fit. I don't think the Australian public quite understand the level of rorts that their tax funding pays for by sabotaging the public system and siphoning funding into privately owned disability factories. The worst part is that they are also exempt under the Discrimination Act due to their religious artificial flavourings, so are never held accountable. By the way, I even advised the Federal Department for Education that I considered there was significant federal misappropriation happening. They essentially just ignored my concerns. We moved on to public schooling, and not surprisingly, both girls are doing fantastic with absolutely no hint of any of the dubious NCCD concerns, as they simply make these up to cash in on manufactured plausible observations that they create due to their private business funding conflicts of interest. Unfortunately, these conflicts of interest are not unique to this one school. This seems to be a common private school rort where the public thinks these schools are actually helping disabled children, when in fact it's more like throwing non-disabled children under the imputed bus. So that is from parent Andre Denitz, who was a former private school parent but now a huge public school fan. We are not going to mention the school because obviously this is hearsay, but we do appreciate the information. And Andre might be right in that the greater public might not understand the rorts that these private businesses, because they're not educational institutions, these private businesses are engaged in. But we at the Dogs, we understand. And there are many public school advocates around Australia who understand just how much this is going on and how many billions of our tax dollars are going to line the pockets of these private businesses. Back to you, Jean.
Yes, well, thank you very much for that, Dale. And thank you very much for that parent for contacting us and telling us what it's like at the grassroots dealing with these private schools that are gaming the system. Perhaps if the government was prepared to account for public money properly, then this would not happen. But of course, you can't do it if you're dealing with religious businesses. You can only do it if you're dealing with a genuinely public system that is publicly accountable through the Australian Tax Office, but also through the government. But let's have a break, shall we?
3CR programs provide information and analysis you won't hear in the mainstream.
Today we'll be looking at the legacy of the US war on Vietnam on Laos.
And as far as corporate capitalism is concerned, it is the worst political and economic system that you can have.
Our laws about jailing refugees and asylum seekers are so well crafted.
Sex is not irrelevant, and we like who we are, but we don't have to be imprisoned by our gender.
Become a subscriber today. Call us on 9419 8377 or visit 3cr.org.au. 3CR, the voice of dissent.
Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
Yes, well, we hope you're listening still to the Dogs program. We're being a bit negative at the moment because there really has been a lot of skullduggery from the private school sector over the last week. And we hear how a very, very aggressive promoter of the Catholic education system, a Mr. McInerney from New South Wales, is up before, I believe it's ICAC, believe it or not. He's up before ICAC for his skullduggery. Let's hear about it, shall we, from Sorrel.
Thanks, Jean. This article is entitled Catholic Schools New South Wales CEO Dallas McKierney to Stand Aside Amid ICAC Probe. The head of the body governing the state's Catholic schools will stand aside after he was named in a corruption probe investigating donations to the New South Wales Liberal Party. The Independent Commission Against Corruption, ICAC, is investigating claims Catholic Schools New South Wales CSNSW Chief Officer Dallas McInerney arranged donations that were undeclared and over the legal limit as part of a branch stacking scheme. In a statement, CS New South Wales said Mr. McInerney would temporarily step aside from his day-to-day responsibilities as part of interim governance arrangements. CS New South Wales respects the role of ICAC and will deal with the matters ICAC has raised in an appropriate and thorough manner, it said. Mr. McInerney resigned from the board of the New South Wales Education Standards Authority on Wednesday. It comes as the heads of New South Wales, two major political parties, moved to suspend current members implicated in the same investigation being undertaken by the corruption watchdog. The ICAC's Operation Rosny named five people who allegedly sought unlawful donations to recruit or renew New South Wales Liberal Party memberships over a four-year period until 2023. Former Premier Dominic Perrottet was governing the state for some of that time, and among the people named in the allegations are two of his brothers, Jean-Claude and Charles. The allegations are also being made against Christian Ellis, Jeremy Greenwood, and Robert Asaf. It is alleged the men collectively sought or took donations that were either not declared, exceeded caps, or were from prohibited donors, including from Mr. McInerney, fugitive property developer Jean Nassif, and hotelier Michael O'Hara. Opposition leader Kelly Sloan responded to the announcement by moving to suspend people named in the corruption investigation who remain members of the New South Wales Liberal Party, Mr. Greenwood and Mr. McInerney. I instructed the party to advise me of who were actual members of the party, who was not, and to suspend those who were, she told reporters. And if these allegations are proven correct, you know, it doesn't meet the standard I expect. The allegations do not meet the standard she expects. Ms. Sloan expressed support for the investigation. It is important that the ICAC has the full powers to investigate, that the names are cleared, because of the sake of the really good members of my party, a party that I'm so proud to lead, for the sake of my parliamentary colleagues, we want this done, she said. The watchdog is also investigating allegations against two Labour Party members elected to Strathfield Council. Councillors Sharagan Mahiswaran and Karen Pen-Sabine are accused of dishonestly exercising their duties and breaching the public's trust, including by blackmailing or illegally spying on Councillor Matthew Blackmore. New South Wales Premier Chris Minns instructed the Labour Party to suspend their memberships. I'm responsible for the Labour Party, and unfortunately, and very regrettably, it looks as if two of our members have been named in that inquiry, he said. I think the appropriate process inside our party is for them to be suspended pending that investigation, which is what I've asked the General Secretary of our party to do. The ICAC launched Operation Rosny after allegations were referred to it, at least in part by the New South Wales Electoral Commission. It will hold 8 weeks of public hearings to gather evidence from July 27th. The Centre for Public Integrity described the investigation as ambitious. The Centre for Public Integrity Director, Jeffrey Watson SC, said the investigation appeared to be one of the largest the ICAC had ever undertaken. An 8 week hearing is quite exceptional, Mr. Watson, who appeared as counsel during the ICAC inquiry into former New South Wales Labor Minister Eddie Obeid, said. He said the most serious allegation involved donations being solicited and taken from top places Mr. Nassif to hurt the career of then Minister David Elliott and remove Building Commissioner at the time David Chandler. Mr. Chandler had ordered Top Place to repair apartment buildings before the company collapsed, owing about 600 creditors nearly $1.88 billion. All of the allegations look serious, he said. Mr. Watson said the allegations would hurt public confidence in the major parties. The votes are leaking from the major parties and going both ways, probably because of this kind of thing, which then leads to disillusionment, he said. Back over to you, Jean.
Well, thank you very much, Sorrel. Now, you don't have to be living under a rock, really, to know that we're in the middle of a technological revolution and that AI is very much in the news these days. And there are billionaires that want to become trillionaires by using AI. But there are a lot of problems that have to be thought about before we can use it for good rather than for evil. And our problem is, of course, and the reason we want to talk about it, is that schools have become a live experiment for AI. Let's hear about it, shall we?
Thanks, Jean. Schools have become AI's live experiment. What now? The influence of AI within Australia's classrooms over the past 3 years has sparked renewed debate on everything from data protection and academic integrity to student wellbeing and assessment. But for many school leaders, the key question remains the same. Is it helping students learn better? Equally important for leaders is the question of whether AI is truly helping to prepare young people not only for the jobs of today, but those that don't even exist yet. This is a challenge at the heart of Ignited, a new national event series from Powering Skills organisation, uniting leading voices from education and industry to explore the future of learning, training and workforce capability. The free online event, which ran between the 12th and the 26th of June, included 10 live sessions and 20 speakers who presented live webinars, on-demand content, podcasts and hands-on toolkits built for educators, RTO leaders and energy professionals ready to lead what's next. AI adoption has now outrun the research. During the week of 15th to 19th of June, two sessions explored how AI is transforming teaching real-time in schools, VET and industry. One of the speakers at the event was Matthew Esterman, who presented a podcast and a webinar exploring these topics in detail. Esterman, who has worked in education for over 15 years as a teacher, school leader, presenter, writer and consultant, is the recipient of several awards, including the Commonwealth Bank Teaching Fellowship for 2023, supported by Australian Schools Plus. In 2024, Esterman founded The Next Word, a consultancy that helps schools and organisations bridge the gap between rapid technological advancement and lived reality. When asked what the research shows about how AI is being used in Australian classrooms today, Esterman said adoption has now outrun the research and the research is running its own race. Useful insights are emerging, but narrow. Far more in higher ed than K-12, much of it on tools we've already outgrown, Esterman told The Educator. We forget these are products from commercially incentivised labs where research runs constantly and rapidly, but not for schools' benefit. Rather than rushing to conclusions, Esterman said schools should focus on what is happening now. We can't generalise anything at the moment about AI in Australian classrooms, except to say that teachers and leaders are the best equipped to deal with this challenge and opportunity because they have students' best interests at the core of their being, he said. What I'd like to see is research into some of the innovative, groundbreaking and assumption-challenging work happening right now, not just looking at how AI affects test scores. We have a live experiment happening right now, and our schools are in it. A locked gate with a flimsy warning sign teaches nothing. Taking a panoramic view of AI on the education landscape, Esterman sees some key opportunities, risks, and guardrails for educators and education policymakers to consider when it comes to how this technology is being used in education. The opportunity includes time and cognitive load. Used well, AI gives teachers back hours and differentiates at a scale we couldn't staff for, he said. The most immediate risk is well-being, particularly students turning to AI for therapy and companionship. That's happening now, mostly out of sight. Esterman said this means that guardrails need to work on two fronts. Inside the school gates, protect data, keep professional judgment in the loop, lead with purpose, not products, he said. Beyond them, accept students and staff will use these tools when, not if, they leave our safe zone, and equip them to do so wisely. A locked gate with a flimsy warning sign teaches nothing. Teaching discernment in the age of AI. With AI literacy becoming an essential skill for educators and students, Esterman pointed to several critical areas of professional development for students and staff in terms of upskilling in AI. For staff, the priority is both training and judgment in context, knowing when AI helps learning and when it short-circuits it, and seeing the well-being risks when students lean on these tools for support they should get from people, he said. We also need to make space for teachers to explore new ways of doing what we've done for generations. For students, it's age-appropriate literacy framed around integrity, disclosure, and safety, not prohibition, including honest talk about why a chatbot is a poor substitute for a friend or counsellor. Underpinning both is epistemic resilience, the habit of asking, how do I know this is true? The aim is to know when to not use the tools and being brave enough to do so. Start human, use AI, stay human. Esterman said he tends to resist the idea that schools should reverse engineer themselves around the job market, pointing out that the most future-ready thing educators can do is deepen what's most human: judgment, ethical reasoning, collaboration, communication, and the ability to keep learning. My shorthand is start human, use AI, stay human, Esterman said. Practically, leaders embed AI as a tool that amplifies thinking rather than replaces it, and stay explicit about where we deliberately keep the friction, because the friction is the learning. Esterman said schools don't prepare students for the future by making them more like machines. We do it by helping them to be the most real version of themselves. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you so much for that, Andy. Of course, the main place with AI is coming from, unfortunately, the US. And while we're on this subject, Jeff has got something to tell us. So over to Jeff.
Good afternoon, listeners. I'm going to start with what's going on about in the United States and arguments about AI in the classroom. Now, you may know who these players are, but I'm just going to mention that Linda McMahon used to be a billionaire who used to organise wrestling in America, and that's why she's been made the Secretary for Education under Trump, because she has quite serious investments in private schools and charter schools, and the whole thing that charter schools would like to do is to replace teachers with AI and chatbots so that they can save money on teachers. So this is the woman Trump has put in charge of education in the United States. Anyway, recently she has criticised the head of the American Federation of Teachers because he had made some comments about AI. This is an article that comes from Diana Ravitch's blog from July 6th, 26, and written by Diana Ravitch. The article is titled, John Thompson, The Absurd Attacks on Randy After She Criticised Tech in the Classroom. And it begins. John Thompson, historian and retired teacher in Oklahoma, thought that the AFT President Randy Weingarten's recent speech on the dangers of technology in the classroom was balanced and thoughtful. Yet the Trump administration attack her for raising valid questions. Trump and McMahon have such a knee-jerk aversion to unions, especially the teacher unions, that they had to attack her even if what she said made sense. Thompson wrote, Randy Weingarten, the head of the American Federation of Teachers, gave an impressive speech at the National Press Club, explaining that students are drowning in tech and that they need their teachers, real human beings, not robots and not chatbots. As I will explain, Weingarten's presentation synthesised both scholarly research and communication with diverse groups of educators and AI users. It was a perfect example of bridging political differences. When I first read the transcript of her plan, I thought it would be hard to understand anyone who wants to improve education and would not want to join her team effort to make life better for young people in the 21st century. But not surprisingly, I was wrong. The Trump administration then attacked Weingarten because early in the COVID pandemic, the AFT, the Australian American Federation of Teachers, pushed for safety measures before reopening schools. It ignored her research and recommendations and claimed that Weingarten is the last person who should be weighing in about what is best for American students. When Newsmax interviewed Linda McMahon after Weingarten's presentation, McMahon first criticised Weingarten for closing schools during the COVID pandemic, although the truth was that she proposed science-based protections to facilitate safe school openings. Then McMahon, Linda McMahon, this is, effusively praised AI in the classrooms. Then the discussion returned to condemning unions for supposedly placing the good of teachers over that of students. And Weingarten's speech on AI was also condemned as part of an AFT policy that lines up perfectly with China First agenda. And the AFT, Federation of Teachers, was accused of Substack for evolving into some kind of content policing organisation. But getting back to Weingarten's speech, NBC reported that she called for blocking most students from using computers in class until they reach the third grade and controlling artificial intelligence programs that are designed to act like real people. She would thus prohibit student-facing AI in elementary schools and ban social companion chatbots until age 16. Weingarten further explained, "I'm wary of the dangers of AI, but it is here to stay." NBC News also reported that Weingarten proposed an independent research consortium to study the effects of AI and screens on student learning. She explained, "I'm not calling for an AI ban or a Chromebook bonfire. What I'm calling for is getting the balance right to harness the benefits of technology while mitigating harm." NBC further explained that some states recently began limiting school-issued devices for the youngest students, and a handful of school districts crafted policies this year to scale back technology in the classroom. But many states and districts are also rushing in to require AI literacy education for students, and AI in schools is rising. That report connects with Dana Goldstein's recent reporting that across the educational landscape, from suburban districts and urban charter schools to community colleges in the Ivy League, schools are pushing back against the misuse of AI. Unfortunately, though, schools serving in low-income students are often under the most pressure to show that they are embracing innovative technology and preparing students for the working world, where it may soon be standard to rely on generative AI. Weingarten's narrative was also consistent with what the Washington Post recently reported. Most teachers use artificial intelligence, but relatively few, just 18%, have received any formal guidance on how to use it. Seeking multiple perspectives, Weingarten had recently visited a school where they used Sal Khan's AI for teaching. Khan once predicted it would be a revolution in learning, but now he acknowledges so far the revolution hasn't happened. And AI tutoring doesn't necessarily make students motivated to learn or fill in gaps in knowledge needed to ask questions. Khan concluded, "I think our biggest lever is really investing in the human systems." An educator at that school also explained, "There's been more enthusiasm for the product amongst administrators than teachers in her school. Moreover, some of the most advanced students have taken advantage of AI to learn new topics, but as far as she can tell, more students are using it just to find answers, which has created massive headache for teachers." Weingarten also drew on research funded by the American Federation of Teachers and supported by Anthropic, Microsoft and OpenAI, showing that critical thinking is directly connected to the content in maths, history and science classes. This is an essential reality often absent from discussions about how schools should respond to the spread of generative AI. Indeed, the common refrain that teachers should focus on abstract critical thinking skills disconnected from content risks de-emphasising the very thing, fluency with a broad set of facts, that supports critical thinking. Domain knowledge is a crucial driver of thinking skill, wrote University of Virginia cognitive psychologist Daniel Willingham in 2020 for The American Educator, a publication of the American Federation of Teachers. Critical thinking for open-ended problems is enabled by extensive stores of knowledge. And Weingarten challenged a number of Democrats, saying that too many want to resurrect the failures of high-stakes testing and are pushing privatisation. After following AFT's footnotes, learning from the evidence Weingarten drew upon and the insights she gained from educators, I agree with Diane Ravitch, who wrote, "Randi has given many speeches. This is one of her best. I see no way we can deny that AI is dangerous, especially for children, and that we must come together in a non-partisan way to reduce its harms while building on its strengths. I see no rationale for seeking simple solutions, and any solutions require listening to a broad spectrum of outlooks. Regardless of what others see as other causes of the decline of meaningful learning, what sense does it make to attack Weingarten's efforts to address this rapidly emerging crisis? I'd argue that today's attacks make no more sense than the right-wing's refusal to work with Weingarten's to build the infrastructure necessary for opening schools during COVID." And that's the end of the article. And I think I attributed it to Diane Ravitch, but she was merely quoting the article by John Thompson, who's a historian and retired teacher in Oklahoma. And he was commenting on Randi Weingarten's speech. So I thought that was a really good and interesting look at the evolution of how AI is affecting classes and classrooms, and the drive by tech billionaires and also just people investing in private education to de-emphasise human learning and emphasise using AI and chatbots as a cost-cutting measure. And ideally, they'd like to remove the costs of having a school building in the first place and have all the children at home learning on their AI bots, I'm sure, maximising their profits. Anyway, with that little struggle going on, I'm going to head you back to the headquarters of the Dogs, and I will wish you a lovely weekend. Have a nice one. Cheerio.
Yes, well, I'm sorry about all the bad news, but we're going to have a break from that and come back with the good news.
You're listening to 3CR, an apartheid-free zone. 3CR's Committee of Management has passed a declaration formalising our commitment to a free Palestine. As an apartheid-free zone, we're committed to boycotting Israel's regime of oppression. We stand firmly against apartheid in Palestine and encourage other organisations to join us in this struggle. Visit our website to read the full declaration and learn more about our commitment to justice and liberation for Palestine and the apartheid-free zone movement.
Well, we hope that you're still listening to the Dogs of Cradle, because now Dale's going to tell us about what the AEU, that's the Australian Education Union, are up to with their Schools for the Future inquiry. They're off to Tasmania. Over to you, Dale.
Thanks, Jean. Schools for Our Future inquiry travels to Tasmania. The Australian Education Union's National Inquiry into Public School Infrastructure is in Tasmania this week, travelling across the state to hear directly from teachers, principals, education stakeholders, and the Tasmanian government about the infrastructure challenges and opportunities facing public schools. Beginning with a series of roundtables in Hobart, the Schools for Our Future Inquiry, chaired by Sharon Burrow AC, is examining the condition of public school infrastructure across Australia and the impact that high-quality learning environments have on student outcomes, inclusion, and teacher workloads. The inquiry is visiting schools across Tasmania to understand the adequacy, condition and future readiness of public school facilities, and the extent to which current capital investment meets the needs of growing student populations, modern curriculum requirements, and safe learning and working environments. This national inquiry into public school infrastructure is the first of its kind in Australia, AEU Federal President Karenna Haythorpe said. We're travelling the country, visiting schools and listening to teachers, principals, education stakeholders and governments to understand what facilities are needed so students can succeed. We have outstanding examples of what high-quality school infrastructure can achieve, but too many schools are being held back by underinvestment. The Tasmanian government cannot do this alone. We need the federal government to step up and be a genuine partner in funding the infrastructure that public schools across the state need. Students deserve 21st century learning spaces that support the full curriculum, well-being and inclusion. And teachers deserve workplaces that are properly resourced so they can do their jobs effectively. We know that when governments invest in modern classrooms, science labs, inclusive facilities, facilities and fit-for-purpose learning environments, students benefit and teachers are better supported to deliver high-quality education. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you very much. That's Tasmania for you. But now we're off to New South Wales, to a really lovely, lovely place up on the Hunter River with Dale.
Thanks, Jean. Public school qualifies for a tree levy grant. Belltrees Public School in the Upper Hunter Valley is on a multi-year journey to rehabilitate the sprawling farmland on which the school is located, using funds from New South Wales Tree Levy Grants Scheme to help fund it. The school's project promotes ecological education, community involvement, conservation of one of Australia's most beloved tree species, and is creating a sustainable koala habitat that includes native eucalypts and other flora. The area of regional koala significance and the school's plan is in line with the New South Wales Koala Strategy. With the Hunter Region Landcare Network also encouraging the community to address critical data gaps in koala habitation restoration, in 2025, Belltrees Public School applied for and was successful in qualifying for a Federation Tree Levy grant. The grant allowed the school to purchase 12 black she-oak plants, as well as 36 eucalypts in three different species, grey gum, grey box, and Blakely's red gum, all of which were purchased from the nearby plant nursery. The school then held a planting day at which students, teachers and locals came together to get things growing. Just like Belltrees Public School, other New South Wales schools with an elected Federation representative can apply for a grant of up to $600 to buy native trees and woody shrubs for planting in and around school grounds. Since 1996, the grants program has offset the environmental impact of Federation's paper usage through the planting of trees in school playgrounds, courtyards, and gardens across the state. Back to you, Jean.
So after hearing about those children and the koalas, you can easily guess, of course, what our great state school is going to be.
Thanks, Jean. And this week's Great State School of the Week is Belltrees Public School. Belltrees is a small school situated in the Hunter Valley in New South Wales. Our school has been delivering high-quality education for more than 140 years. The school is located on the Belltrees property, 33 kilometres east of Scone. We have a current student enrolment of 9 students, with families from the surrounding townships of Moonan Brook, Moonan Flat, Stewart's Brook, Belltrees and Gundy attending. The school is well equipped with the latest technology and resources that allows teachers to provide engaging, hands-on learning opportunities focusing on academic growth and development. Students have the opportunity to enjoy flexible learning spaces within the classroom that allow them options for maximising their engagement with each other and the curriculum. The cattle yards, poultry house and vegetable gardens also provide students the opportunity for leadership and environmental education activities. BPS is a collaborative school which interacts with other schools in the Upper Hunter region and beyond. Through our collaborative efforts, students enjoy academic workshops, sporting events and social experiences which lead to lasting friendships and strong bonds, especially as students move into high school. The parents and carers of BPS have positive partnerships with staff to improve the learning and well-being experiences for their children and are valuable contributors to our school community. And now some facts and figures from the My School website. The school has 9 students. The ICSEA value of the school is 927, which is below the average of 1,000. Students are representative of a rural community, 3% in the highest quartile of socio-educational advantage, 17% in the second quartile, 31% in the third quartile, and 49% in the lowest quartile of SEA in the community. 29% of the students have a language background other than English, and 22% are Indigenous. This is a school with many disadvantaged rural students with one dedicated teacher. It costs the taxpayer $151,000 per pupil, well above the Gonski resource standard, since this is a tiny one-teacher rural school to educate a student at this school. The school receives only $159,000 from the federal government and $588,000 from the state government, only $2,897 from fees and $4,972 from private fundraising. The capital grants in the last 3 years have been nil. All this public and private money is money well spent. The NAPLAN results indicate that the children in this school are doing brilliantly, all well above average. These children are receiving a very, very special education. Back to you, Jean.
Well, congratulations to those nine little children up there at Belltrees Public School. It's only the public system, of course, that would give them a school, isn't it? I don't think any private school that's got its eyes on the profits would be up there in Belltrees, but the public system is, and the taxpayers are there, and they're doing a great job. But our time has run out. It's up to me now to remind you about the Fight for a Better Deal for School Staff and Fully Funded Schools rally outside Ben Carroll's office on July the 16th at 4:45 p.m. at 473 Keeler Road, Nidri. And if you want to find out more about the dogs, then of course there's our website at www.adogs.info. www.adogs.info. But from our wonderful producer Dale and her offsidey Andy and Jeff and Sorrel and myself, it's bye for now.
I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe, says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die, says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find Joe Hill. It's there you'll find Joe Hill. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he.
To 3CR Community Radio 855 AM. Visit the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/podcast to hear the most recent recording from each show, or 3cr.org.au/streaming to listen live.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We rely on the financial support of listeners like yourself to keep going. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au. And thanks for your support.